You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the February 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. I want people to feel hope, and I want people to feel love, especially during times like these, says Stephen James, 25. He stars in If Beale Street Could Talk and Amazon's Homecoming. In the opening photograph by Dan Martinson, styled by Samira Nasser, Vanity Fair's Krista Smith speaks with Stephen James. Before starring opposite Julia Roberts in Homecoming and in Barry Jenkins' If Beale Street Could Talk, you got your start on the Canadian teen drama Degrassi. I've always been pretty reserved, but after taking drama classes in middle school to get more comfortable performing in front of people, I thought I should try out for television. I'm from Toronto, and the show's been around for like 30 years. I had the opportunity to be a part of two new seasons in a small role 10 years ago, but there will always be those diehard Degrassi fans who still remember me from that show. And soon after, you made the transition from teen soap to film. Yes, I had my first lead in a little indie film called Home Again. It's a really cool story about three immigrants who return to their native Jamaica. The first time I sat in a theater and watched myself on a screen was an out-of-body experience. It blew my mind. Now you're starring in the powerful love story If Beale Street Could Talk, Jenkins' follow-up film to his Oscar-winning Moonlight. Finding out that Barry Jenkins was making this film so soon and the chance to be part of telling such a beautiful story was a dream. I put a couple of scenes on tape, sent them to Barry, and asked if he would meet me for lunch. He agreed and explained his vision for the film, so then I sent him some more tapes just to show him how invested I was in the character. A week later, he called and offered me the role. Did you take the same approach with landing your role on Homecoming? Well, honestly, the series is based on a podcast, and I was a little apprehensive to listen because I didn't even know what a podcast was, never heard one in my life. But I wanted to be a part of it once I heard the creator of Mr. Robot, Sam Ismail, was on board and that this little-known actress, Julia Roberts, was cast to star in it. You play a young veteran under the care of a counselor played by Julia. What was your experience working with her in her television debut? She's electric, and she has a very loving, warm sort of aura, so the walls were broken down for me within the first 5 minutes of meeting her. I enjoyed every second we got to share together. I wouldn't trade that whole process for anything. And you recently finished filming 17 Bridges with Chadwick Boseman, Sienna Miller, J.K. Simmons, and Taylor Kitsch. It is a fantastic cast. It's an action thriller about a manhunt in Manhattan. All 17 major bridges are shut down for the search to ensue, and it all takes place over the course of one night. It's going to be something different than anything out there, I think. I'm really excited. There's a lot of Oscar buzz surrounding Beale Street. How do you hope the film is received? I hope that it sparks conversation, starts dialogue. At the root of it all, I want people to feel hope, and I want people to feel love. I think that's the through line of the film, especially during times like these, when you have love and hope, it's amazing the things you can see yourself do. What Stephen loves, style icon, Pharrell. Shoes, right now, Nike Air Max 270s. Accessory, Ray-Bans. Jeans, All Saints. Place, Toronto. Necessary extravagance, a Burberry sweater for my French bulldog, Smokey. Favorite discovery, Sugarfina Gummy Bears. Whom do you text the most? My mom, by far. Musicians at your dream dinner party? Jay-Z, Rihanna, and Georgia Smith. Now here's the watch list. What to watch this month by Richard Lawson. What to go see? Cold War. Who's in it? Polish actors Tomasz Kot and Joanna Kulig, who's a dead ringer for Jennifer Lawrence. We'll remind you of writer-director Paweł Pawlikowski's last black-and-white stunner, the Oscar-winning Ida. Why now? This fraught story of love in communist Poland isn't cheery, but as a study of people bearing up under bitter times, it hits home. Plus, there's lots of gorgeous music. When you can see it, in art houses now. What to tune into? True Detective. Who's in it? Oscar winner Mahershala Ali. Streep scion Mamie Gummer, and the always intriguing Carmen Ejogo. will remind you of, hopefully, Season 1 of True Detective and not Season 2 of True Detective. Why Now, Nick Pizzolatto's heavy, brooding anthology series, had a rough sophomore outing, but this third installment, taking place in three different time periods in the Ozarks, has us intrigued anew. When You Can See It premieres this month on HBO. What to Stream, Vanity Fair, Who's In It? Captivating Olivia Cooke, Cutie Johnny Flynn, and Cut-Up Michael Palin, will remind you of a juicy PBS miniseries available all at once. Why Now? Sure, we're loyal to the title, but mostly it's the great young actress Olivia Cooke as social schemer Becky Sharp that's hooked us on this witty adaptation of William Thackeray's 1848 novel. When You Can See It, on Amazon Prime now. A Far Better Thing, actress and director Pamela Adlon garnered critical acclaim for her show Better Things, based on the chaos of her own life. Now, following a very public break with her longtime collaborator, Louis C.K., she's finding strength in her creative vision. By Ariel Lev. Opening photo, Pamela Adlon in 2017. You know Pamela Adlon. You've seen her. Maybe the first time was back in the early 80s, when she was a teenager playing a pink lady in Grease 2, or Kelly Affinato on The Facts of Life. Or more recently, Marcy Runkle, Californication's delightfully brash resident cokehead, or Pamela, Louie's fictionalized version of herself. You've definitely heard her voice, at once distinctively raspy and surprisingly chameleonic, which has given life to a host of cartoons, including 90s kid classics Recess and Rugrats, the beloved Bob's Burgers, and an Emmy Award-winning stint as Bobby Hill on King of the Hill, starting in 1997. Or maybe you discovered her in 2016 with the celebrated arrival of her own show, FX's Better Things, which for two seasons successfully tackled the complex, messy, funny, and poignant emotional terrain that a single working mother of three daughters traverses. A show that, a little over a year ago, seemed on the verge of combustion, collateral damage in yet another Me Too revelation. The final episodes of Season 2 aired under a looming shadow. Adlon's longtime creative partner and co-creator of Better Things, Louis C.K., had just admitted that allegations of sexual misconduct against him were true. It was unclear whether the show, unabashedly feminist, dreamed up by one of Hollywood's hardest-working women, would survive the reckoning. For Adlon, whose father was a noted comedy writer-producer, it had been a long road to her own show. One that started in the early 1980s while enrolled at Manhattan's Professional Children's School. I was a student there, too, until I called her for this story. It had been 30 years since the last time we spoke, sitting next to each other in 10th grade math class. "Ariel," she exclaims now in greeting, "it's effing crazy. Are you ready?" In 1983, she landed her first big job as an understudy in the original company of Neil Simon's Brighton Beach Memoirs on Broadway. "I was with that play from Los Angeles to San Francisco to New York," she says. "It was like having Broadway blue balls. I never went on stage." The trajectory from high school Pamela Siegel to show-running supernova is not unsurprising. A self-described bulldog when it comes to survival, Adlon is driven by an insatiable work ethic. As a teenager, in between acting jobs, she'd work part-time at vintage clothing stores and hand out flyers for the New York Pops. She learned a trenchant life lesson that nothing is to be taken for granted when, in her 20s, her parents went bankrupt and lost their house. "When my dad turned 50, the switch got turned off for him," she says. The irony is not lost on her that at the same age her father found his career on the decline, hers began to blossom. "I spent years waiting for the phone to ring," Adlon says. She describes sporadic work, at times going on unemployment, before finally getting a break. A voiceover job for radio led to steady voice work over... led to steady voice-over work for animated shows. "That sustained me," she says. Throughout, Adlon was also raising three daughters as a single parent, which ultimately provided the material and training ground for creating and running production on Better Things. Knowing what to take on and what to say no to, making choices, living with consequences, all built up the muscles needed for leadership. It was while acting and writing on FX's Louie that she was given the opportunity to pitch her own show to the network, but she hesitated. Between her regular shows and her kids, her plate was full. But then she did a guest arc on a big-budget show, and it hit her. "I looked around and saw all the money and time being wasted," she says. "I got chills, and I thought, okay, I can do this. I'm ready to do this." She wrote the opening scene, in which Adlon's character, Sam, sits on a bench in a mall, scrolling through her phone as her youngest daughter stands next to her, sobbing theatrically. When Sam meets the eye of a disapproving onlooker, she turns to her. "Hi," she says. "No nonsense. Do you want to buy her the earrings?" This would become the voice of the show. "I wanted to see regular people things," Adlon says. "I don't see people like me on television. Everything is a little too manicured." Better Things is drawn from the raw, emotional extremes of Adlon's life. As she describes it, a woman wandering through all of it by herself, surrounded by chaos. Sam juggles auditions, navigates romance, and alternately bickers with and lovingly cares for her trio of daughters, who respond in kind. "You're working well beyond your expiration date," her middle daughter deadpans during a fight. "There's no way Hollywood is going to keep you around much longer." The show resonated, garnering reviews that called it solid and smart, and the most poignant love letter to single motherhood that has ever aired on TV. A 2016 piece on this magazine's website notes the show's remarkable ability to dive deep into the realm of melancholy without ever veering into bitterness. Then, in November 2017, as the second season, of which Adlon had directed every episode, came to a close, the New York Times released a report that five women had accused CK of sexual misconduct. Soon after, he publicly admitted to the allegations and was subsequently fired from his ongoing FX projects. "All of a sudden, he's gone. My show is dangling from a precipice," she says. "It was so huge, and it was so devastating." She released a statement expressing her shock over what she called CK's abhorrent behavior and noted her deep sorrow and empathy for the women who have come forward. "There were an extraordinary amount of people who were affected," she says. "How one person's actions could shake up the lives of so many is precisely why she chose to channel her own energy toward turning chaos into art." She parted ways with her longtime manager, whom she'd shared with CK, and began the daunting task of putting together a writer's room for the third season of Better Things. "I've never been in a writer's room, let alone run a writer's room," she says. "Sitting down, meeting writers, reading their stuff, how do you do this? Is this person going to get along with this person? It's like making a table at an effing bar mitzvah." She hired four writers, two women, two men. Bouncing ideas off of one another was a joy, she says. Phones were turned off. A sacred space was created, and storylines emerged. "My mind was being cracked open every day in a new way." It's clear that this is a time of liberation and regeneration. "Change is extraordinarily good," she says, sounding optimistic. And in keeping with her regular practice of art imitates life, change is the thematic focus of this upcoming season. It's fitting. She has always relished the way a script might morph, if needed, as she takes it from the writer's room to the set to the editing room. "Having the ability to make space for that flexibility," she says, "is one of the advantages of being in charge." Heard it here first. These six celebs have voices that gave life to beloved cartoon characters. Fergie voiced Sally Brown in Peanuts. Years active, 1984 to 85. Role, America's archetypal little sister, better known as front woman for the Black Eyed Peas. Flea voiced Donnie in The Wild Thornberries. Active, 1998 to 2004. Role, feral child raised by orangutans, better known as the bassist for the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Frank Zappa voiced the Pope in Ren and Stimpy. Active, 1992. Role, beleaguered Pope, better known as prolific solo artist and frontman for the Mothers of Invention. Jennifer Garner voiced Mama Llama in Llama Llama. Active, 2018 to present. Role, anthropomorphic single mom, better known as Alias's Sydney Bristow, purveyor of organic baby food. Keith David voiced Goliath in Gargoyles. Active, 1996 to 97. Role, loving rock-hard patriarch, better known as Mr. Rogers Carpenter, Requiem for a Dream's Big Tim. Michael Cera voiced Brother Bear in the Berenstain Bears. Active, 2003. Role, tree-dwelling eldest child, better known as Superbad's Evan, Arrested Development's George Michael Bluth.
Thank you.
On to Beauty, Remembrance of Things Past. These perfumes invoke the transportive power of memory by Durga Chu Bose. In the photos, Gucci, The Alchemist, Garden, A Song for the Rose. Ormani Papier Carbone. Tory Burch, Love Relentlessly, Feu de Toile. Imaginary Authors, St. Julep. That olfactory feeling, scent, our time machine, smells implicate us, conjure memories, home, a kitchen, cardamom, winter's first snow, the linen closet, cracking open a library book, summer vacations and the briny sulfur of the sea. Smells are sweet as oboes, wrote Baudelaire, or corrupt and rich. There's the ambushing kind, the passerby who smells like an old love. Sandalwood, vetiver, plum. While our scent palette is a portal to the past, perfume, the cloud we spritz and walk toward, expectant, offers escape and identity. An invisible shroud that lingers like a calling card. She was just here. Dreary late winter is the perfect time to be transported. D.S. from D.S. and Durga offers warm saffron and gardenia. While Tory Burch's Feu de Toile, inspired by the memory of powerful love, brings a different kind of heat. Papier Carbone from Ormai, a new natural brand, captures the aroma of carbon paper once used in French classrooms. Chanel Les Exclusifs, 1957, bestows a timeless comfort, musk, vanilla, honey. For Alessandro Michele's latest Gucci collection, The Alchemist Garden, scents play games with our imagination, telling a story inspired by the rare specific of childhood stuff. A Song for the Rose is an ode to Michele's mother, who once kept rose essence in a beautiful deep blue vintage perfume bottle, explains perfumer Alberto Morillas. Vivid imagery and the vague ache required for memorializing is Gucci's sweet spot, after all. But also of interest is how each fragrance will be interpreted by its wearer, the memories evoked, both material and made up. Similarly, Imaginary Authors characterizes its fragrances as layered narratives. The recurring plot, the personal, the intoxicating. Founder Josh Meyer traveled to Germany's Black Forest as a child. The scent memory of the place returns to him at home in Portland, Oregon, over and over again. Rain-drenched forest, his own Proustian Madeleine. Fragrances like St. Julep, a mint field in Mississippi, and Cape Heartache, the pine and fog of Meyer's Pacific Northwest, encourage personal fictions, a nudge to imagine not just what has been, but what may be. Perfume, after all, is for the person who might see herself as a character, who's always known there's more than meets the eye. onto the fairground. Good Company, a dinner and dance homage, paid tribute to Alvin Ailey as his company turns 60 at this season's opening gala in New York by H.W. Vail, with photographs by Jamie Yoon. "He was always with me," said recent honorary Oscar winner Cicely Tyson of Ailey. "There was nothing that I did on film, television, stage, that he wasn't there for. He was there when I was nominated for the movie Sounder, and that was the same year, 1972, that the company had its first season here at City Center." "Ailey lives," announced Angela Bassett as the curtain rose on the evening's performances, which included an excerpt of Memoria, one of the late choreographer's most personal works. In the photos, Ailey choreographed the Memoria Ballet in 1979 as an elegy for a friend. Gala chairs Angela Bassett and Cicely Tyson catch up over dinner following the performance. Cicely Tyson on stage with Ailey dancer Chalvar Montero. Dance icon and actress Carmen de Lavallade. A scene from Revelations, Ailey's signature masterpiece, and the most widely seen modern dance piece in history. The troupe's dancers, patrons, and fans took to the dance floor after dinner to celebrate Ailey's legacy in the only way they could. Here's Sonia Soraya with the first person column. Seeing stars. Astrology isn't science, so why can't I stop trying to divine the intention of the heavens? Opening illustration by Antti Kalevi. The language of astrology now permeates the mainstream, luring even natural-born skeptics. In this illustration, a woman is shown lying on her back, book aside, looking up at the night sky. 3 or 4 times a year, Mercury appears to loop back on itself for a period of about 3 weeks before continuing on its journey. The smaller planet doesn't actually go backward. It just looks that way because we're orbiting the Sun at a far slower pace. All the planets can appear to us to be traveling in reverse. Mars, for example, was retrograde this summer in a gorgeous transit that made the planet glow like a portentous red eye low on the twilight horizon. To the ancients, the bright, mysterious, meandering planets told a story. Mercury's has endured into the present to become the kooky spiritualist go-to excuse. If the Roman god of communication, tricksters, and travelers is caught in a loop, heaven help us mere mortals. On a humid summer Friday in Park Slope, I stopped in front of a twee shop window with a poster-sized decal on it. Your 2018 Mercury in retrograde public service announcement, it declared, ticking off advisements. Don't close the deal. Don't initiate new projects. Don't schedule meetings. Don't travel a lot. And don't repair your car, purchase technology, make agreements, or accept or start a job. I had my reservations, grammatically and otherwise. Mercury is never in retrograde. It is retrograde, and I'd love to meet the wafflers who won't finish anything for 3 weeks at a time. Yet I had, at that point, been weighed down in a cloud of faulty communication. An editor rescheduled the same interview 4 times. For some reason, none of my text would send. Maybe I should have been following the rules. The language of astrology in our millennial moment has emerged from the dusty corners of hippie bookstores to permeate the mainstream with chic vigor. It's popular, progressive, and often quite stylish. Yoga teachers, massage therapists, and acupuncturists have dished their horoscopic concerns to me. Academics and poets are conversant. At a wedding in 2017, the sister of the groom told me she'd keep an eye on my transits with the help of an app. A co-worker informed me, sotto voce, that no one on our team was a Cancer. And then there's me, reminding people to keep the faith during the storms of eclipse season or at the threshold of a new moon. How did this happen to us? To me? I don't do healing crystals. I have a healthy skepticism of miracle cures and nutritional fads. So why does this web of astral significance speak to me? At least part of the answer is that I live on the internet, where automated Twitter accounts give updates on planetary transits, apps offer minute details about the heavens, and crucially, anyone can access their birth chart. There may be no greater manifestation of the purported millennial penchant for navel-gazing than obsessing over a snapshot of the heavens at the time and place of one's arrival. And yet, astrology links that moment to two of the biggest mysteries of a person's existence. Why am I the way I am, and what is going to happen to me? The universe is pitiless and vast. But when all else fails, you can pore over a diagram to study your place in it. This summer, a familiar self-loathing roared back into my life. Depression is always useless, but it's especially useless when everything else is going pretty well. Somehow, I got a job writing for this magazine and convinced a nice man to marry me. Still, I couldn't shake a sense of dread I'd been carrying my whole life. It feels like a dark, spreading stain at the center of my mind, one that I carefully keep at bay with my pill and my therapist and occasional half-hearted jogging. But these don't always work, and sometimes the stain bleeds out. Everybody has a struggle like that, right? If it's not dread, it's despair or grief. And there on that liminal battlefield, where it's going, in the right direction, but it feels really bad, that's where astrology really works. It gives us the tools to tell stories for ourselves, to rewrite personal drama as a clash of planetary forces, to reinterpret trauma as one step on a journey toward peace. And it does feel magical when a reading appears to know you intimately, when it reveals to you something you weren't aware of, or something you had not yet said out loud. So, this summer, I read posts from astrologer Chani Nicholas for guidance. Other things that helped, fancy ice cream, vaping, listening to The Weeknd, I'm not proud. She assured her readers that it was an intense time, especially for those of us with Capricorn, my rising sign in our chart. I keep returning to one question she posed late in August. What does it mean to get to live even a teeny tiny part of your dream? Later, when I spoke to Nicholas for this piece, I found myself telling her about a moment I'd had recently. Sitting on the fire escape, looking at the sky, and trying not to cry. A star was directly overhead, and my phone told me it was Vega, Capricorn's next-door neighbor. Gradually, we both realized the same thing. I had been staring at the astrological upheaval of the summer, retrograde Mars in my rising sign. The red planet was slowly drawing a bright path over the exact point in the sky that was dawning in the east the morning I was born. My whole life, my mother has handed me bizarre, charmed objects. Rocks with fossils in them, dried seeds, semi-precious stones on a chain, with instructions to wear them, wield them, or keep them on a shelf. This is all strange, sure, but given that she was raising us to be Hindu in Central Florida, everything my mother asked us to do was strange. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.